Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine and... Oh, hang on.
I quit. And I know it is a face-up machine. You're just keeping a secret from me.
That hasn't happened before.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies. Movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, as the title suggests, I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, distribution stories, all the ingredients that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how difficult it is to get a film off the ground. Each episode, I cover 2 films. I'm going to get on straight away with the first of them, a particular comedy favourite of mine, this one. Let's go to 2015. I'm going to play you a clip from the trailer and I'll come to the story of this particular film right after this.
Tell me where the bomb is. 10 seconds or you're dead.
Interesting. I'm the only one who knows
where that nuke is. Well then, in that case, I'd say you'd better start.
I didn't do it on purpose. There's like a ton of pollen in here.
When I quit teaching and joined the CIA, I thought I was going to be this amazing spy, and I'm still just the same boring person I was.
You play it too safe.
I just hear my mom's voice. Just blend in, let somebody else win. Making a wave isn't always brave.
Brilliant.
Give up on your dream, Susan. Just to write that in my lunchbox.
We've intercepted chatter that Rayna Boyanov knows where that nuke is. She knows the identity of all our agents.
We need someone to find the bomb without being detected, but it can't be any of you.
We need someone invisible.
I'll do it.
Okay. Thanks, lunch lady.
I'm serious.
Don't let me down, Cooper.
I will not. I will let you up.
Stop talking.
I will let you up.
And that is a clip from the 2015 action comedy film Spy, written and directed by Paul Feig, and starring Melissa McCarthy, Jason Statham, Rose Byrne, Miranda Hart, Bobby Cannavale, Alison Janney, Jude Law also in the mix there. And so for this one, we sort of have to start with a film that came out in 2006, the James Bond reboot Casino Royale. Paul Feig had grown up being a fan of spy movies, loved the James Bond films as well, but it was a trip to see Casino Royale that kick-started the idea for what would become Spy just under a decade later. And he recalled going to see it. He said, I was like, that's how they should look. It all added up to wanting to do something like that. And he said, I realised that nobody's going to let me do one of those, a James Bond film, but then this is my opportunity to write something for the funny women I like, and I took it from there. A woman who becomes a spy, the brains behind the real spy, everything came together. Now, when Paul Feig went to see Casino Royale, he was in movie jail, self-confessed movie jail at the time, that he had directed a couple of features, none of which had really broken through at all. And so he'd been working on television. The TV series Freaks and Geeks is much loved, not least by me. But that hadn't turned into a big commercial hit to go with its critical love. Likewise, he was working on things like The Office, which was a hit, but there were lots of people also in the midst of working on The Office. So there was nothing really coming through directly in his name, but he was still in conversations regularly with Judd Apatow. And it was Judd Apatow who suggested he take the directorial reins on 2010 film Bridesmaids. Now, when Bridesmaids hit big, and I will come to it on a future episode of the podcast, that's when he had the clout to get his own films moving again. He was out of movie jail, and he decided early, the next film he made was The Heat, starring Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy, but he decided early on that he wanted to do that spy movie as well. And his approach to doing so was he was going to write a script for a spy film, and then he was going to put the jokes on top of that. What he didn't want to do was a parody. He wanted to do a real spy movie with real stakes, but also for it to be funny. And so in an interview at RogerEbert.com, he talked about going to, while he was in post-production on The Heat, and how he'd just gone to see Skyfall as well, which had reignited his passion for this particular project. He said it really just came out of this thing of what I had the best take on. If I had a great female spy who was trying to figure all this stuff out and who was relatable, and my brain kind of went on fire because I knew how to do that movie. It was no more political beyond that, he pointed out. It was just about all the stuff that I knew I was good at and was excited about doing, a female spy comedy. It was done. And he said, my head suddenly flooded with ideas, and I went to the studio even without the story worked out, and they loved it. Then I wrote it, and it just kind of took on this snowball effect. Now, Feig's production company, Feco, had inked a fresh deal with 20th Century Fox in early 2013 as well. So it was all coming together. But it's worth noting that even though he'd enjoyed successes with Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids and The Heat, he didn't write Spy for her. Because as much as he wanted Melissa McCarthy to take on the lead role in the film, at the point Spy was originally going to shoot, it was going to be at the end of 2013. And Melissa McCarthy was double booked at that point. She was committed to making the film Tammy. And so in terms of casting, she was certainly not a shoo-in for the lead role, because Feig, as much as he wanted her, hadn't envisaged that she would be available for it. Of people who were mentioned, I think Zooey Deschanel was mentioned in relation to the film at one point. I'm not sure exactly which role it was in, but her casting wouldn't really pan out. But then Spy would be slightly delayed as well. News nonetheless first landed of the film when it was called Susan Cooper. That was its original name, in June of 2013. This was when Feig was a week or two away from releasing The Heat. And the kind of assumption from those of us reporting on film at this point was, if The Heat was a hit, then this would be his next project. But he hadn't found a lead star yet. Already at that point, it was being described as a realistic comedy about a female James Bond. The script was written. Feig did have another project on the go at that point. He'd done a mother-daughter comedy that he'd scripted with Katie Dippold, who'd co-written The Heat with him. Dippold and Feig also wrote a sequel for The Heat, which would have been based in and around the idea of The Silence of the Lambs, but Sandra Bullock decided she didn't want to do that, so that never happened as well. But there were an assortment of things that he was juggling at that point. Yet it was in July 2013, it was clear that Susan Cooper was going to be the next film to go, because all of a sudden Melissa McCarthy's availability had opened up, that the schedules now had aligned and she could indeed take on the role of Susan Cooper in the film. Fox was going to back it. It was going to give it a very quick green light as well. And so then it came to the point of other pieces of casting. For the role of Rick Ford, the experienced spy out in the field, the experienced operative, the studio was assuming that Feig was interested in comedy performers to take that on. But as he told me in an earlier episode of the Film Stories podcast, we did a live event with him in London a year or two back, he had someone else in mind. I'll let him explain why he felt Jason Statham was the right fit.
You know, and Jason's, you know, he makes his living being a cool, tough guy, you know. So it's like at some point I would kept thinking, oh, he's going to just say, I can't do that or just, you know, beat me up. but no, he was just so game to do it because he just had the best time with it. And it was, it's funny, when I wrote that role, because I had a meeting. I was a giant Jason Statham fan forever. My wife and I, just every movie he's in, he's so great. And so I actually, when you're a director and you're actually doing okay, you can have a what's called a general meeting with somebody. Go like, I would just like to meet Jason Statham and talk to him. So he comes to my office one day. And I'm so nervous because I'm like, oh, my God. Because I don't know what to expect. And I'm like, is he going to be really mean? Is he going to be tough? Is he not going to want to talk? And I walk out into the lobby. He's like, hey, Jason. He's like, hey, Paul. And a big smile. And it's just like, oh, he's like a really nice, normal guy. And so I said, I want to write something for you. And so when I wrote, before I did Spy, when I wrote Spy, I wrote it for him. But everybody from the studio would read it and go like, oh, so you're going to cast like Will Ferrell or Ben Stiller or somebody in this role? I said, no, it's Jason Statham. And they thought that was hilarious. I was worried they weren't going to let me do it. But thank God they did, and thank God he did it. So
it had been the film Crank that had put Jason Statham firmly on the radar of Paul Feig, as it did for many of us. I've covered Crank in a previous episode of this podcast. And so what Paul Feig told me once, that it was while watching that first Crank film that made him realise that Statham could also be funny, that, quote, he could play things where he was in on the joke. And Feig described to me how he became obsessed with this idea. He said, I have to put him in a comedy, but it took years to figure out what it was. And he said, when I was writing this, I thought, I need this kind of testosterone-laden rival spy for her. This is it. Finally, I can write something for Statham. And so I put it together for him, but then thought, he'll never do it, will he? Well, I put that question to Jason Statham once, a sentence I do not say lightly, and he said, as you know, I'm always apprehensive to look like an idiot. I could do it in a Statham voice, really. I know I should, but you'll just have to imagine. And he said, some comedies, they want you falling on your face and doing silly things. But he explained Paul Feig had a great idea that he wasn't going to make a spoof or a barefaced silly comedy. He wanted to do a sophisticated spy thriller. The situations that would be happening in the story would be funny. And so Statham was interested. Took him a while to say yes. He was first linked to it in October 2013. He wouldn't actually sign on the dotted line for several months, but crucially, he would sign on the dotted line. And then the casting continued. It's clear it wasn't going to shoot at the end of 2013 anymore. And in fact, the casting news was coming through into 2014. Rose Byrne was cast towards the end of 2013, but then other people were coming in early the following year. I mean, you get names like Alison Janney, 50 Cent, you get Jude Law, Peter Serafowicz, also all joining the ensemble. But the casting of Rose Byrne was really important in particular because that led to changes in the script as well. And as Paul Feig explained to RogerEbert.com, he said, I had her and Melissa come in months before and had them just start reading the scenes. And Rose Byrne was doing a variation of what I'd written, and it just wasn't right for her or anything. And so Feig explained, we tried different things, danced around it. Then she started using an English accent and she started doing the insults. There were insults in the script, but she started doing them in this English accent in a matter-of-fact way. And it was so funny that I figured out the dynamic and went back to rewrite the script to accommodate that. The last piece of the filming jigsaw was Miranda Hart. She would sign up in March of 2014, and it was time to go. That filming would begin at the end of that month in Budapest. It would run for 55 days in the end. Now, because he was shooting in Europe, Paul Feig could move to French hours for the production. That he'd been shooting his previous films in America, and you work to very, very long hours on a film set, on American film sets. But the French hours system restricted the working day of film to 10 hours. because it didn't require a fixed lunchtime. So catering tables would be laid out, food would be available, so you could go and graze, you could go and eat on the go at any point. But the offset of that was, at the end of 10 hours, no matter where you were, you are shutting up shop unless an extreme circumstance, and everyone could just go off and see each other, see their families at the end of the day. There are a couple of night shoots in the midst of it all as well, but always on French hours. And he described the challenge of that. He just says you can do it, you just have to be really organized. And it was only because he was shooting Budapest in Hungary that he was able to even do it. Now, it ended up in Hungary because of tax breaks. He explained this to Post magazine because he said, I also wanted these glamorous European locations, as I'd originally written it as taking part in Paris, Venice and Capri. And once we started scouting, he explained, we realised that Budapest could double for a lot of places. So I just rewrote the script so that most of it happened in Budapest. He also said, I did the same thing with The Heat, where Boston originally doubled for New York. And then I just thought, why not set it all in Boston instead? For Feig, the fresh itch that he was scratching was action scenes, which he hadn't really done at this scale before. And he was keen not to heavily storyboard them, but there was some degree of previs work that needed to be done. I'll come to that shortly. He was also worth noting in the midst of all of this that he took a phone call from Ivan Reitman, who had a script for a Ghostbusters film and wondered if Paul Feig would be interested in that. So the first conversations that led to 2016's Ghostbusters with Paul Feig directing took place while he was on set in Hungary on Spy. I will come to Ghostbusters separately in a separate episode of this podcast. But also, the way that Paul Feig was shooting this film was he was getting what was on the page, but he knew he was working with comedic performers, he knew he was working with comedy, and so they were just trying different things, as Melissa McCarthy would explain. The thing about Paul is he's very keen to pump a few bits that aren't in the script in there, little hidden things, and there's a scene at the end, you just go with it. The whole process of him directing goes that way. Everything's on a post-it note, there's new stuff coming in, and it's kind of like organized chaos, it was explained. For certain sequences involving Jason Statham, and I'm really underplaying this, but Jason Statham in Spy, I love the Stath. The Spy is one of my outright favourite Jason Statham films. I just think he's exceptionally well cast and exceptionally funny in it. There's a bit right at the end which I wanted to put a clip in of, which is one of my favourite Statham moments across his career. I won't spoil it for you. But what I can say, and I did ask Paul Feig about, is that on set, Statham was being fed lines pretty much on the spot. That he was going from working on Fast and Furious 7, which he'd been working on as well, which had been a very, very serious and very taxing film for all sorts of reasons. And then he would come to Spy, and at first they were a little bit nervous about just throwing him lines to say on the spot, but then they started throwing him lines on the spot. Again, I'll hand over to Paul Feig, who can tell you more about that.
So with Jason, I would sit there and I would have these jokes, and then people were handing me jokes and they were so ridiculous. And I was like, he's going to kill me. Like, at some point he's going to punch me because these jokes are so stupid. But so I'd just go like, and I'd read it off and he would like burst out laughing and then he'd do it. And so we just got so hooked on like, what is the stupidest jokes we can write for him?
And that's why the DVD and Blu-ray releases of Spy have an enormous amount of outtakes, brilliant outtakes. If you find the stuff in the film funny, the stuff that they didn't use is also really quite superb. And they gave themselves the space during the shoot to be able just to try things like that. Now, there was still the action. I mean, there's quite a lot going on in the film. And as Feig would explain to RogerEbert.com, that the knife fight sequence that takes place set in a kitchen, he talked about how his stunt coordinators, J.J. Perry and Walter Garcia, got together to pre-vis everything with their stunt team. Then they filmed a version of what it should be. And then they took that to Paul Feig ahead of filming began, so he could add jokes to it, to build on it and to find the funniest, scariest, most action-packed thing that we could do. What Feig didn't want to do was just have an action scene for the hell of it. So as soon as it was designed, he would just tailor it to the kind of film that he wanted to make. This also presented, Spy also presented special and visual effects challenges as well, that in the end there are 12,000, imagine that, 1,200 effect shots in the film. And one of the big challenges is a sequence that takes place on a plane where the plane just starts to go, let's just say, a little bit shonky, and people get a bit weightless in it. And it wasn't something they really had the money to do. And as Feig would tell Post magazine, that whole weightless plane sequence, we never had the budget for it. It was originally meant to be a much bigger sequence with two Learjets chasing each other through the Alps. But Feig explained, I shot it so the action was all inside the plane. And then when we began cutting it together, we were able to add some exterior VFX plane shots. And he said, I fell in love with the Dolby Atmos system on Post as well. And we designed a lot of things flying around and overhead just to showcase it too. It was a 55-day shoot to those aforementioned working hours, and the whole thing stayed absolutely on schedule as well. But then what this afforded Feig was time in post-production to shape the film and to properly test it. He's a big believer in test screenings, in comedy in particular. He just has talked several times across several movies about why it's so important. He does have a thing about not showing his films to friends and family to get feedback off them, because they're just not going to be candid enough. And so what he did was he took the film back to Burbank in Los Angeles, of course, for 6 months of editing work. But within 3 weeks, he had what he would describe as his first screenable cut of the film. Again, going to Post magazine, he said, Post was quite long, as I shoot so much extra material, so we do a lot of versions of the movie. And he says, I'll start test screening 3 or 4 weeks into my director's cut to get a sense of what works and what doesn't. He says, my goal is always to not fall in love with any one cut, which is what happens the longer you work on one cut. So we'll do test screenings every few weeks, pull stuff out and change stuff. And he says, the difference with this film is that as it's such a big action film, Fox Post rigged it up so we could have full temp mixes on a stage, as it really needed that scope. And it meant that the versions that they're presenting as well were the kind that you could put in front of a test audience properly. In the end, he tested it. I think it was 10 different test screenings of the film that Spy went through. And across the 6 month edit, it came down to a running time of 120 minutes bang on. That originally the plan from 20th Century Fox was to release it on the Memorial Day weekend in the US. By early 2015, it sort of changed its mind on that and moved it just a week or two back to June the 5th of 2015. But Spy had come together pretty much start to finish once the green light had been given in very, very quick time. This was 2 years from the point this was going to happen to, in fact, just slightly less than 2 years to it being seen on a cinema screen. It was premiered at the South by Southwest Festival on March the 15th, 2015, and that was nearly 3 months ahead of its proper theatrical release. The critical response to the film was, I mean, comedies never really get good reviews, but Spy did. Spy got really quite good reviews. In fact, in some places, really, really excellent reviews as well. A singled out for praise, Jason Statham in his first full-on comedic role. I don't know where you class Crank. I mean, I think there's all sorts going on in that. But this was playing very much to comedy and the joy of the face-off machine. If you've seen the film, you know. And so he was praised, as was the dynamic between Melissa McCarthy and Rose Byrne. The fact that McCarthy and Feig clearly worked well together was singled out as well. And the general feeling was this was a funny film, a really good funny film. There were a couple of people who didn't quite buy it, but still, it was generally going into cinemas off the back of positive word of mouth from critics. Now, the title had, of course, changed. Fox decided Spy was a better title than Susan Cooper in the end. It's worth noting as well that Paul Feig went into this when he originally conceived the character of Susan Cooper and the idea of the movie. He had a franchise in mind, that his template was the James Bond movies, and his love for the James Bond movies. And he just thought, if he sets this up right, there could be room to do more of these films. going into cinemas, this had been, I mean, at this stage, it was his most expensive film. It was costing $65 million to make. And so, I mean, an upgrade on Bridesmaids and The Heat. And so there was a little bit of uncertainty heading into its release. Went into cinemas in the US, June the 5th to the 7th, 2015, straight in at number one. $29 million opening weekend. And Paul Feig had a third straight hit on his hands. He was making comedic films headlined by women and also turning them into box office hits. Now, it's not as if it wasn't a competitive week in cinemas that weekend either. That Spy displaced the previous week's number one, San Andreas. I'm coming to that in a future podcast as well. San Andreas made $25.8 million on its second weekend. But also debuting that same weekend was Insidious Chapter 3 in third place with $22 million. There was a rival comedy as well. The thing is, here's a bit of good fortune. It was the terrible Entourage movie, $10.2 million, but given the strength of the TV series behind it, there was a feeling that Entourage might bite into Spy's box office a little bit. Turned out not to be so. The quality of the film, I think, didn't really help it there. It's worth noting too that Love and Mercy, which a really underrated and underseen film, opened in 11th place on 481 screens in the US with $2.1 million. Other films that were around at that point, Mad Max Fury Road was a month into release and remained great. That was in 5th place. Pitch Perfect 2 was sat in 6th. Tomorrowland, coming to that shortly as well, that's in 7th place with, by that point it made $76 million after 3 weeks on release. Avengers Age of Ultron was the big film around at that point. That was up to $438 million. Cameron Crowe's Aloha, a really interesting film. Again, there's a conversation about that somewhere down the line we can come to. And The Poltergeist do-over was also in the top 10. The following week, I mean, it was a competitive summer. Jurassic World roared into cinemas with $208 million opening weekend gross. But Spy held most of its audience, $15.6 million in its second weekend on release. And as much as the big films kept coming, Inside Out was out the following week, Dope was out the following week as well, Spy just hung around in the top five for a little bit, even as other comedies popped up. Ted 2 was out, and after Spy was 4 weeks on release, that helped itself to $33 million on its opening weekend. But Spy was still in the top five, closing in on $100 million gross. Terminator Genesis, Magic Mike XXL, they were coming the week after. And by the time Spy dropped out of the top 10 at the US box office, it had been 6 weekends on release. It was films like Minions and The Gallows and Selfless that knocked it out in the end. By the time it completed its US theatrical run, $110 million in the bank. Not shabby at all. Also, Feig had been open about the fact when he was making the film, he wanted to make comedies that travelled overseas as well. And the fact that Spy notched up $124 million outside of the US for an R-rated comedy as well, it was not playing to a broad family audience. Well, the total worldwide gross was $235 million. And that was seen as a result, not least when it did pretty well on home formats as well and continues to be watched and enjoyed today, really. There was, I should know, I couldn't get this double verified, but nonetheless, I'm going to tell you anyway, because it did pop up on one or two places. There was a slight problem putting it to the American Ratings Board that a prosthetic of someone's nether regions was required. And in order to get the R rating off the American Ratings Board, apparently they had to show the ratings board the particular prosthetic, presumably to show them that, I mean, bluntly, it wasn't a real ding-dong. So there you go. Your life is enriched for knowing that, I'm sure. In terms of moving on to Spy 2, I mean, Feig was keen to make it. As I understand it, whenever I cross paths with him, not very often, but whenever he's got a film out, I interview, I always ask about Spy 2, and he remains keen to do it. It's something that he's interested in, but there have been a couple of things that worked against it. I mean, number one was he was busy. He was straight onto the Ghostbusters film, which came out in 2016. And the other story I heard, which he didn't disagree disagree with was that Fox in the end had a bit of a choice to make, because that same year, 2014, another spy film had hit big for the studio. That would be Matthew Vaughn's Kingsman: The Secret Service. And by the sounds of it, it came down to a choice from Fox. Does it want a sequel to Spy, or does it want a sequel to Kingsman? And it went with the sequel to Kingsman. Meanwhile, Feig was off doing other things, and then Melissa McCarthy started making comedies with Ben Falcone fairly regularly instead. And her and Paul Feig, as much as there's talk of them working together again, haven't actually worked together on a film since 2016's Ghostbusters. It's been a long time for such a really strong comedy partnership there. Spy sits there. It sits there on Disney Plus at the point this podcast is being recorded. And when people watch it, there's very few people who do not like the film. And it leaves itself so open to further adventures, both for the characters of Melissa McCarthy and Jason Statham. I really hope one day it happens. But in terms of Paul Feig's career, it is my favourite Paul Feig film. But also in terms of the comedies of 2010s, it's a really, really high watermark. And I mean, Jason Statham comfortably, do not say this lightly, in the top three Jason Statham films as well. Which brings me to the halfway point of this particular episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your time. I'm going to do some parish notices, if that's all right with you. First of all, if you like this podcast and don't mind giving it a bit of a lift, there are three ways, other than lending it your ears, you can do so. I'm very appreciative, I should point out, that you've lent it your ears. So I thank you in the first instance for that. If you want to help us financially, if you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew and put some money in the pot there, you tend to get the podcast early pretty much every week. You certainly get it ad-free as well, and you find out what gossip is going on behind the scenes, the other Film Stories projects that are noodling along to various degrees. So there's a fair amount going on there, and thank you to everyone who supported me there. Costing you absolutely nothing is to subscribe at your podcast home of choice. Thank you so much for doing that. It really helps with algorithms and things I don't understand. Likewise, if you can leave ideally a hugely positive review, that would be massively, massively appreciated. If you are a nerd like me who loves film magazines, print film magazines, especially big chunky ones, then Film Stories is also a big chunky film magazine, 168 pages every issue, on really nice paper as well. Imagine that, just like they used to make. And it's just full of film writing that we don't tend to do much in the way of superheroes. I mean, other people do that really, really well. There's no point in me competing there. But it's a mainstream film magazine that basically everything else. We talk about independent film, we talk about mainstream film, we dig out stories from the past. You can find the latest issue at store.filmstories.co.uk. And likewise, I do a print magazine for under 15s, the kind of magazine I wished had existed when I was growing up. And it's partly written by them as well. And they get paid for writing. So they get to see that they're, and hopefully appreciate that their writing has value and has worth. It's called Film Junior. We're working on a new issue of that at the moment, but all existing issues are available at store.filmstories.co.uk. And that's also where you can find our Blu-rays. We've done UK exclusive Blu-rays of Sneakers, which is now sold out, I'm afraid, of the brilliant No Way Out, which has not sold out, and the brilliant Bull Durham, which has also not sold out, all at store.filmstories.co.uk. But that is enough, I think, in the way of parish notices. I'm going to whisk you back to the 1980s now, to a film that's not really talked about an awful lot, but one I'm really, really fond of, and its sequel as well. I'll set it up with a clip from the trailer, as always. I'm going to come to the story of this particular venture, the other side of this.
Rawley Tyler is an FX man, the movie's master of make-believe. He can show you a thousand ways to die.
Hey, Doc! Great special effects!
But now somebody wants Rawley Tyler to do it for real.
We want to stage a fake assassination, Rawley, and we want you to supervise it.
Who's the we?
Justice Department.
I'm a special effects man. I deal in make-believe. I'd like to keep it like that.
We just thought that we might be able to utilize your particular genius to help us out.
And what if someone takes a shot at me?
You are 100% protected. I give you my word.
That job that guy wanted me to do? I think I'll do it.
Someone else is writing the script.
and casting him as the killer.
I haven't done anything.
What if he put in real bullets?
If one person suspects.
Sorry, Raleigh. No loose ends.
Listen up to something. He tried to kill me.
We are then all the way back in 1986 for FX, directed by Robert Mandel, written by Gregory Fleeman and Robert T. Meginson, and starring Brian Brown, Brian Dennehy, Diane Venora and Clifty Young. But the origins were with an unsolicited screenplay put together by, on paper, an unlikely pairing. You've got Gregory Fleeman, who was an actor, and he joined forces with a documentary filmmaker by the name of Robert T. Meginson. They come up with the idea for this film, and they submitted the script. They were just thinking this is going to be a low-budget TV movie, pretty much that will do. But it's one of those strokes of fate, really, that the script landed in the right place at pretty much the right time. Because it turned up at the desk of Dodi Fayed, a resourced man, and his producing partner, Jack Viner. Now, Dodi Fayed had produced Chariots of Fire that had won the Best Picture Academy Award. And so, that was both a profitable venture and a hugely successful one, bringing a lot of cachet. And so the script to FX was read by Jack Viner. And he took a look at it and thought, you know what, it's a little bit above a TV movie, this, and we could do something a little bit more with it. And that's pretty much what he did, that he kind of accelerated the film from that point and got a distributor interested. That would be Orion Pictures, just a couple of years before Orion made RoboCop, which I think is one of the most iconic of Orion's films. But Orion was a big deal for getting movies made in the 80s. I mean, we've talked about several of their films over the course of this podcast. And by August 1984, it looked like not only had the script been acquired, but it looked like FX was going to get going really rather quickly. So the personnel was looking quite different to what we ultimately ended up with. A director by the name of Roger Spottiswoode was attached, for instance. Now, Roger Spottiswoode would go on to do the James Bond feature, Tomorrow Never Dies. I think Stop or My Mom Will Shoot was one of Roger Spottiswoode's films as well. And the cast was due to be led by, get this, Kurt Russell and Robin Williams. Now, neither Russell nor Williams was at the height of their box office powers at that point. Russell was higher up the chain than Williams certainly was. But by January 1985, things had changed. The Orion Pictures was on board, and a budget in the region of $10 million was being staked on FX. But changes in personnel, really. I mean, Williams had completely dropped out, but then Fayed was still mulling Kurt Russell as a possible option. Another name that was in the mix at this point and would have been a lot more expensive was Harrison Ford. Mel Gibson hadn't hit the height of his fame either. He was just kind of in the middle bit between the Mad Max films and the Lethal Weapons films. His name was tossed around, as was that of Oscar winner George C. Scott. But in the end, it was, on paper, two relatively low-key leads who took the two main roles in FX. Two excellent actors, but not really two box office names, per se. Brian Brown was one of them. Now, he was about to have a very big hit with the film Cocktail, which would star Tom Cruise, of course. But at that stage, the film was still a couple of years away. So, again, a lot of work in television, and people who knew his work, great. But people who didn't, just not really a recognisable name. And it's quite telling, actually, in the final poster that was put together for FX, neither actor's names is anywhere near above the title. The other lead, a theatre titan, Brian Dennehy, also a whole bunch of screen appearances as well. Brilliant actor. And I one of the many reasons I really like this film is its casting went for actors over stars, went for really good acting talent, and in the two lead roles as well. I think that really helped kind of stoke the film up a little bit. In terms of a director, Dodi Fayed and Jack Viner went a slightly different way, and they hired a man by the name of Robert Mandel. Now, he had primarily cut his teeth at this stage in theatre, in off-Broadway theatre as well, but he'd made a film for Warner Brothers called Independence Day. Now, the problem was, it wasn't that Independence Day. It was a 1983 movie that opened for the studio in just six cities in the end. And, well, it closed very, very shortly afterwards. It was not a success. And Warner Brothers was very, very quick, really, to wash its hands of it. However, the New York Times would note that Independence Day, again, not that one, would go on to earn a cult audience on US cable television. And it showed that Robert Mandel knew how to direct a feature. But as Jack Warner also described to the New York Times, the one thing we didn't want to do with FX was hire an action director, because this was a very easy script to turn into an action film. And Warner argued you can get an assistant director to direct your action sequences. Brian had to be a real person who fought with only the things he had at hand, not a James Bond character. You really had to care about him. And so they cast actors, they cast a director experienced in theatre, used to dealing with actors as well. In came Miroslav Ondrejek to shoot the film as well. And I mean, there's talent all around the call sheet and the cast and crew for FX, but a relatively low-key production that got underway in April of 1985. Now, it was 12 weeks that was allocated for the shoot, a very physical shoot, as you would expect at this point. But by the nature of the title of the film, you know that this is going to have special effects in it. That is at the heart of the plot of the film. The shoot would be centred in and around New York City. There's a bit that takes place in Geneva as well. But this was very much a New York shoot. It was there for a couple of months. And the special effects that were going to be at the beating heart of the film were under the stewardship of a man called John Steers. Now, John Steers had Oscars on his mantelpiece. He'd got one in 1965 for the James Bond movie Thunderball. And he was a joint recipient in 1977 for working on a small film called Star Wars. Now, Steers was used to working in a Hollywood where the effects department was one person and you're just left to figure it all out. That on Thunderball, he was just given almost carte blanche, really, to do what he thought was needed to be done. That it was a very, very niche role he was in on the production team. And it's only over the ensuing years that special effects became a bigger and bigger thing, to the point where on 1977 Star Wars, there was a much bigger team working on the film. And he got a bit frustrated with the expansion of effects teams, because at heart, he was a puzzle solver. He liked just being in the midst of it by himself, just working all this stuff out and not having to answer and get I's dotted and T's crossed. That's not to say he worked alone. In the case of FX, he brought in a man called Conrad Brink to help him. But as Steers would argue to the New York Times, he said there's too much specialisation. He talked about miniatures, motion control, animatronics, prosthetics. And he just thought about that and just said, old timers like myself do everything. Now, to a degree, this was going to be one of the first films, again, that cast actors in the lead roles, knowing that it would be the special effects that would sell the film to a degree. And so director Robert Mandel knew that he was in very safe hands with Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy. But the effects was going to be the effects themselves were going to be crucial to this. And so John Steers was trying all sorts of things, and it was all visual effects. It was all special effects, all in camera stuff. And there were explosive charges that were wired to electronic detonators that were embedded in the walls of a set. There was this is a New York Times description, a tidal wave of lobster tanks that fills the screen using barely 200 gallons of water. Not a single lobster was killed in the sequence in the film. If you've seen the film, you'll know which one it is, although several were appropriated by extras for their private dinner table scenes, it also says here. The most tricky of the effect shots that were being done for the film, and I mean, it was being done on a relatively modest budget as well, not cheap, but still modest, was said to be one about having a character, I'm going to spoil a lot as I can, standing at a window being shot by a sniper. And as the description goes, the difficulty came because the audience must see the bullet go through the window and then hit the actor, and the actor was wearing, well, virtually no clothes. And so, I mean, this was just the kind of puzzle that John Steers liked to like to try and solve. And he was asked how he did it, and he just said, I don't tell you how the tricks are done, because otherwise I won't be employed again. I do want to acknowledge that John Steers would pass at the ridiculously young age of 64. His final film was the terrific 1998 movie The Mask of Zorro, which I've covered on this podcast before. But this was primarily one or two people just in the midst of a very physical production, putting all these little tricks on screen, using all the experience of what the 7-8 James Bond movies that he'd done, and, you know, really with really quite strong results, I would suggest as well. And the actors were enjoying it as well. I mean, Brian Dennehy, before he passed, did an interview with Film School Rejects, and he would talk about making the effects films. There were two in the end, and he says, you know, the thing about FX, both FXs, because the first one was certainly more close to what I'm talking about, is they were fun. They were fun. The old-fashioned movies were. There was very little serious stuff involved. And as Dennehy argued, when people got killed, it was kind of part of the fun, part of the gag. And they were not essential to what the story was. And he just described it as, it was just fun to be in it. Fast-moving, funny, amusing. And he also argued that Brian Brown was one of the best when it comes to that. We were all having a good time, and it showed in the picture. And he did say, we could have made a couple more. I wouldn't have minded that at all. And I will come to the sequel side of effects shortly. 6th of July 1985, the filming on the movie wrapped. It, as I said before, a 12-week shoot. And so into post-production it went, with editor Terry Rawlings working on the film. By this stage, he'd got films like Alien, Chariots of Fire and Blade Runner to his name. And they fashioned the cut, as you would expect. Now, that cut was test screened also, as you would expect. And this modestly priced, relatively modestly priced film suddenly gave Orion Pictures the kind of test scores he just simply wasn't expecting for the film. I mean, on paper, this could have just been a throwaway B-movie, but it was clear that what had been spotted in Gregory Fleeman's and Robert T. Meginson's script, that it was far more than a TV movie, well, that was on the money. And Orion had scheduled this for release on February the 7th of 1986. It was coming out in an off-peak period of the year. February in the 1980s is when you either put Valentine's movies or films you almost want to bury or don't have particularly high expectations for. But the test scores led the studio to think, do you know what, this one might actually work. It went before critics, first of all, and the reviews for the film were really, really strong. That not least by the fact that the budget had clearly been stretched so far. I mean, it looks a lot more expensive than it actually was. The acting was particularly praised. Brian Dennehy in particular. I mean, the man just majestic in pretty much every performance he gave in. And the critical response was acknowledging that this was just a really, really, exactly what Dennehy said, a really, really fun film that was punching well above expectations, well above weight as well. 108 minutes, rollicking good time. Orion sniffed that it might have something of a hit on its hand. And it sort of did. I mean, it sort of did. It came out it came out that weekend, February the 7th to the 9th, 1986. Now, opening opposite it was Woody Allen's film, Hannah and Her Sisters, which was in 10th place with $1.2 million. FX opened in an era where the opening weekend wasn't the be-all and end-all, I should note, with $3.2 million in 5th place. Now, there were a couple of Oscar films around at that point. The Colour Purple was in 2nd. That had been out for a couple of months. Out of Africa had been out for a couple of months. That was in 4th. The film at the top of the charts was Down and Out in Beverly Hills, which was earning a princely sum of money for Walt Disney. That it had grossed nearly $14 million after 2 weeks on release. These were all impressive numbers as well. Films also in the top 10 at this point. Murphy's Romance was in 3rd place, and that had been around for nearly 2 months. Young Blood was in 6th. Iron Eagle was in 7th, with The Best of Times and The Jewel of the Nile also rounding out the top 10. And then the film hung around for a little bit. I mean, if you fast forward a week, I mean, by week 3, it's still in the top 10. It's down to 7th place. It's just holding off the challenge from a new opener by the name of The Hitcher. Remember The Hitcher? And it would be, I mean, by 4 weeks in, just clinging into the top 10 as movies like Pretty in Pink and House were landing. By the time FX finished its run at the US box office, $20 million in the bank. That was not bad change at all. It did, I mean, it barely made a scratch outside of the US, but for a $10 million production, it had doubled its it had doubled that at the box office and would go on to set, to earn quite a bit of money on videotape as well. But there was a feeling amongst executives at Orion that they kind of missed an opportunity here, that there had been a chance for the film to go a little bit wider, but that the title was wrong. And in fact, this was something the New York Times came to in an article that ran a couple of weeks after the film's release. And it quoted Charles O'Glenn, who was then executive vice president of advertising at Orion Pictures. And Glenn said that nobody understood what the title meant. He said, "We had to accept the title because the producers were very keen on it, but they thought the two letters together would be provocative, like the film MASH. MASH, when it was written, was M asterisk A asterisk S asterisk, that's really hard to say, H, in the case of FX, F forward slash X." And they were kind of thinking something along those lines might work. Orion weren't particularly fans of it, but Dodi Fayed and Jack Veena were. But as Charles O'Glenn would reflect, sometimes it's what you're up against. And there was a far more palatable title, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, that was the main competition for the film. And it was Down and Out in Beverly Hills that prevailed. And so by this point, Orion was considering changing the name of the film for its release outside of America, which it duly did. So outside of the States, it's known as FX : Murder by Illusion. It is worth noting there was another mitigating factor in how difficult it was to sell, and that's without movie stars, they kind of needed Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy to do the publicity circuit and to raise awareness. But there was some difficulty with that, because first of all, Dennehy had not too long before been heavily promoting a different film, Cocoon, directed by Ron Howard. And so talk shows weren't going to be particularly enthusiastic to book him again so soon. Meanwhile, Brian Brown was off in China making Taipan, and so he wasn't available to do the publicity circuit. Not only, therefore, was Orion dealing with a title that he didn't really believe in, he couldn't really put its stars out in front of cameras to kind of vouch and punt for the film. That notwithstanding, it still brought in a profit for the studio, and so, I mean, the sequel talk started pretty much instantly. The same month the film was in cinemas, Dodi Fayed was looking to get a sequel movie to FX movie, and at one stage it looked like it was going really fast as well. There's a report in The Hollywood Reporter suggesting that the report's dated 19th of June 1986, saying pre-production was already underway on a sequel movie that was going to be made in London. That, though, didn't happen, but there was other stuff going on. So NBC instantly saw the potential, the television network NBC in the States saw the potential and approached the producers about doing a television spin-off of FX. And then John Steers would say that at one stage he was offered money by government agencies just to, let's just say, simulate, reflect some of the things that he'd managed to put on screen, that they might find some of his work particularly useful there. The road to a sequel would take a little while in the end, that the movie wouldn't come along for, well, we're into the 1990s before we got FX2, it would arrive in 1991. It was written by Bill Condon, actually, the sequel. Bill Condon would go on to earn an Academy Award for the film Gods and Monsters, and directed films such as Kinsey and Dreamgirls, a pair of Twilight movies, Disney's live-action Beauty and the Beast. But Condon's earlier work saw him making the first Candyman sequel, Farewell to the Flesh, as well. And so for all the acclaim that he had later on in his career, he earned his stripes in genre stuff like this. And I've spoken to Bill Condon a couple of times, interviewing him for his films. In fact, there's an episode of this very podcast from 2019 where we talk about the film Good Liar. And he's proud of FX, and he's not a filmmaker who disowns the work he's done before, and he's clearly a fan of the FX movies that he was, well, not least because he was involved in the second. The second film, I mean, Richard Franklin would come in to direct that. There would be a change in personnel behind the camera as well. Now, he reportedly didn't finish directing the film. I couldn't fully get to the nub of this, but Vic Armstrong, legendary stuntman Vic Armstrong, would talk in his memoir about he was taking over the shooting of the film towards the end of the production. And there was enthusiasm for an FX3, but FX2 just simply didn't do the money. It cost $18 million to make. Its box office return roughly the same as FX, $21 million in this case. And that ended really any chance of a third film going forward. There was, though, in the end, that spin-off television series. It did ultimately happen. FX the series, as it was cunningly called, ran from 1996 to 1998, and that would have no involvement from the personnel who were involved in the movies. But still, I mean, it did pretty well. It ran for a couple of seasons. And much like the films that it's based on, I mean, it made a little bit of a mark, but kind of left the potential for more. There's no sign, really, of any kind of modern reboot of the FX films, even though, if I've got this right, they now fall under the MGM catalogue, which is owned by Amazon, and Amazon is mining that back catalogue for reboots of all sorts of films, not least Roadhouse, which is on the verge of release as this podcast is being recorded. I think it could do worse than have a look at FX, but it would need to be done with its foot very much in practical effects and with computers nowhere near it. The first film absolutely nails that. And if you've never had one of the delights of this podcast is bringing to your attention a film that might not have made it onto your radar, I would just simply suggest, and I've given no spoilers away, FX is one well worth seeking out. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, I'm on social media. I'm on Blue Sky, actually. I quite like Blue Sky at the moment. I'm at Simon Brew there. I still just about keep my paws in Twitter, whatever it's called at the moment. That's at Simon Brew as well. Film Stories is on there at Film Stories and also at Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. Over at YouTube, youtube.com/filmstories. Then you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew. Our shop is store.filmstories.co.uk and our website updated every weekday with news, reviews, features across movies, TVs, games. We don't do clickbait, so we do things the difficult way that all the algorithms don't like, so it's your support that keeps us going. You can find us at filmstories.co.uk. Thank you to everyone who helps spread the word about what we do. Now, though, I've of course outstayed my welcome, as I always do. I'm going to leave you in peace. The main thing, as always, is you all stay safe and you all stay well. I'm off to watch another load of movies and I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, take care, look after yourselves. Bye bye.